Good morning. You are listening to Lowell Association of the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Barry, and I'll be reading to you today from the Lowell Sun and maybe later from the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. I hope you're doing well this morning. We again have the Lowell Sun here, Thursday, February 26th. The top story, top of the fold, by Peter Currier. Moulton's guest escorted out of speech early. Washington. Staff from U.S. Representative Seth Moulton's office escorted State of the Union guest Marcelo Gomes da Silva out of the congressional chamber Tuesday night after a social media post from the Department of Homeland Security targeted the Milford team. Gomes da Silva, 19, had been invited to President Donald Trump's State of the Union speech by Moulton after Gomes da Silva's experience last May when he was arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Gomes da Silva was brought to the U.S. legally by his family as a child, but his visa eventually expired, something he says he did not know had happened. He was pulled over by ICE last year while driving his father's car to volleyball practice. As ICE said afterwards, the agency had been seeking his father. Gomes da Silva was then arrested on discovery of his lapsed visa and held in ICE office at 1000 District Avenue in Burlington for 6 days. After his release, he described extremely poor and crowded conditions for the detainees inside. Nearly a year later, Gomes da Silva found himself in the upper gallery on the congressional chambers of the congressional chambers as Trump delivered what would end up being the longest State of the Union speech by any U.S. president, while Moulton sat with his colleagues down below. As first reported by the Boston Globe, though, less than halfway through the speech at about 9:45 p.m., Gomes da Silva was escorted out of the room by Moulton's staff due to a social media post by Department of Homeland Security naming him and Moulton directly. Ex post in question was made by DHS less than an hour before Trump began his speech and said Moulton plans to bring illegal alien Marcelo Gomes da Silva as his guest. Gomes da Silva is an illegal alien who has no right to be in our nation. We are committed to enforcing the law and fighting for the arrest, detention, and removal of aliens like him, said the DHS post Tuesday evening. On Wednesday, Moulton posted a video on Instagram of him talking with Gomes da Silva after the speech outside with the Capitol building visible in the background. In a comment under that video, Moulton said Trump could learn a thing or two from Marcelo Gomes da Silva. After sitting through a speech full of lies about immigrants, after DHS tried to intimidate him and we made the call to pull him from SOTU, State of the Union, for his safety. Marcelo didn't back down, said Moulton's comment. He showed grace, courage, and perspective. Marcelo made some good trouble last night, and I cannot overstate how proud I am of him. In that video, Moulton asked Gomes da Silva for his thoughts on the speech, to which Gomes da Silva said he was pretty disappointed. I can't say I was surprised, though. Sadly, I had to get escorted out because the DHS said they don't want an illegal alien like me to be at the State of the Union, said Gomes da Silva. It's pretty disappointing, but at the same time, I feel like it kind of saved me some peace of mind, because not a lot of things that he was saying I agree with. Gomes da Silva noted in the video that he was sitting around both people who oppose and support Trump in the gallery. There were some people next to me that would stand up and applaud him, and there were also people that would stay sitting down and actually talk bad about what he was saying. So it's really interesting to see both parties, both ideas, and see what they think, said Gomes da Silva. In a statement issued later Wednesday, Moulton said Gomes da Silva has been in the U.S. since he was 6 years old. Zero criminal record. You're not making anyone safer by targeting him. You're just proving how far you'll go to terrorize young people trying to build a future in this country. Moulton is running against Senator Ed Markey in the Democratic primary for Markey's U.S. Senate seat for Massachusetts. Markey and several representatives from Massachusetts chose to skip Trump's speech Tuesday, including U.S. Representatives Lori Trahan, Jim McGovern, Catherine Clark, and Ayanna Pressley, opting to attend an alternate event dubbed the People's State of the Union. Also, we have a big story here. Shining spotlight on a cruiser crash. MSP cam catches aftermath of alleged drunk trooper's wreck. By Colleen Cronin. After responding to a brutal 2023 cruiser crash involving State Police Sergeant Scott Quigley, which led to the death of a disabled man a month later, states seemed concerned about the consequences the sergeant would face. Unless he's S-faced, I'm not worried, one officer was caught saying on mass state police dash cam footage obtained by the Herald. But allegations that Quigley was indeed S-faced at the time of the crash came to light last month, more than 2 years after the incident. According to a police report, Quigley only received a marked lanes violation at the time. The accusation that Quigley's blood alcohol level tested at 0.114 at the hospital following the crash, the legal limit is 0.08, came out in a wrongful death suit filed by the victim Angelo Schettino's family. The lawsuit has put a spotlight on the Woburn crash, not just how Quigley may have been liable for the incident, but how the state police handled the investigation that followed. In dash camera footage, the trooper assigned to investigate the crash, Sergeant Jennifer Penton, seems willing to delay an interview with Quigley after being told by Lieutenant that she shouldn't come to Leahy Hospital. You guys were going to send someone down to interview, the Lieutenant asks her over the phone picked up on the dash cam's audio. So Penton starts to reply. What I'm saying is that right now it's not the time for an interview. The lieutenant cuts her off. No. I just want to give him his belongings, she said. His gun is going to be secured at HQ, but I have a backpack with just whatever was personal. Penton is currently suspended with pay for an unrelated incident that occurred at the State Police Training Academy in 2024. Following an independent investigation, Penton was charged with manslaughter for her alleged involvement in the death of a recruit and perjury for allegedly lying to the grand jury. On the video, Penton tells the higher-up that she would head first to another hospital where the driver of the other vehicle was transported before dropping Quigley's personal belongings at Leahy. As she starts to pull away from the scene, another unidentified officer approaches her cruiser. The two start talking, and Penton relays her conversation with the lieutenant. Lieutenant's like Scott hit his head. So someone said, you're coming to interview? Penton says, I don't want to blank interview, Scott. Like I don't, obviously, I have all the info from the exchange, and if he's not feeling up to it, we can wait and give him some time to rest, the other officer finishes her sentence. Yeah, give him some time to rest, Penton agrees. Penton continues to tell the other officer that there's no rush and this isn't going to be my call. Like, I'll do whatever a lieutenant, but doesn't finish the thought. I wasn't there. There's no witnesses, Penton says. I'll see what the other driver says. She tells the other officer that the van Quigley hit was on their side of the road, and it appears that Scott had his phone out. Penton tells the officer she's heading out to talk to the driver. Give Scott some time to get his bearings, the other officer replies. Yeah, exactly. They don't even want me to come. Like I'm not freaking IA, Penton says. IA is usually short for internal affairs. the branch of police department that investigates officers for wrongdoing. They're looking out for him, she says. Maybe they know it was his fault. And they're like, whoa, let's just wait. Then when the other officer says, unless he's S-faced, I'm not worried about it. To which Penton replies, unless there's something more I don't know about. Penton eventually interviewed Quigley 8 days later. Quigley, through his attorney, Christina Pujols Roman, has pushed back on the allegations. In a statement released on February 20th, Ronan said Quigley has consistently maintained that this was an unfortunate and tragic accident, not a criminal act, and that he has cooperated fully with investigators and remains confident the objective evidence will ultimately support his account. Throughout his law enforcement career, as well as during his prior military service, he has never been the subject of disciplinary proceedings, Roman said. We ask that the public allow the investigation to proceed fairly and without speculation. In court filings, Quigley has also argued that he is immune from civil penalties because he's on-duty officer at the time of the crash. In a response to questions about the footage, a Mass State Police spokesperson pointed to a letter from Colonel Jeffrey Noble, which said the agency has opened internal affairs investigations into several individuals related to the crash and hired an outside firm to review the agency's handling of the situation. This will be subject of the review, the spokesperson said. Suffolk County District Attorney's Office is also looking into whether or not Quigley will face criminal charges for his part in the crash and the death of Schettino. Although the case would usually fall under Middlesex County's jurisdiction, the police referred the case to Suffolk because Quigley was embedded at Middlesex as a homicide investigator. Meanwhile, Quigley's involvement in a Lowell murder trial has paused that trial and brought up questions of prosecutorial misconduct. And the last story on page one from Beacon Hill, Tizoglio files emergency motion after Campbell struck down the audit suit. State Auditor Diana Tizoglio has filed an emergency motion with the Supreme Judicial Court in response to Attorney General Andrea Campbell filing a motion to strike down the auditor's lawsuit about the voter-approved audit. Tizoglio is seeking to use outside counsel in a push to have the high court compel the legislature to comply with the audit. Attorney General Campbell has abdicated her duty to defend the public interest. Democracy is under attack, and the people deserve an answer from the courts, Tizoglio said in a statement. AG Campbell claims I am a dissenting state official and that she is a gatekeeper to the courts, but those gates were never meant to be locked to the people. Gatekeeping justice isn't leadership. It's obstruction. The courts belong to the people, not the politicians. So yes, I dissent. This latest legal action by the auditor's office comes after Campbell last week filed a motion with the SJC to strike down Tizoglio's original legal action, which requested the state's highest court to allow her to bring on outside legal counsel to represent the office and to compel the legislature to comply with the audit. Campbell argues that Tizoglio is violating settled law in bypassing the attorney general by filing her legal challenge. The AG calls her office the gatekeeper empowered to determine when, if ever, the Commonwealth's intra-governmental legal disputes require judicial resolution. Campbell and Tizoglio have been locked in a legal tug-of-war since Tizoglio sought to carry out the legislative audit approved by 72% of the voters in 2024. Siding with legislative leadership in blocking the audit, Campbell has claimed that Tizoglio has not answered basic questions regarding the scope of the legislative audit, which she argues may also be in violation of the state constitution. In her emergency motion, DeZoglio argues that Campbell should be disqualified from representing the auditor's office in its legal pursuit because of her conflict of interest. There's a clear and evident conflict of interest between the state auditor and the attorney general, the emergency motion reads. Conflict of interest is most obvious with respect to the attorney general's motion to strike, but also exists regarding the underlying complaint by the state auditor against the speaker and clerk of the Massachusetts House of Representatives and the president and clerk of the Massachusetts Senate. Both the filing and substance of the attorney general's motion to strike are evidence of her adversarial posture that precludes and disqualifies her from representing the state auditor's interest in the matter, said the motion. Earlier this month, DeZoglio filed a lawsuit against legislative leaders, specifically House Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka, going right to the SJC to compel the legislature to comply with the audit. It also seeks permission to appoint outside counsel selected by the auditor's office to special assistant attorney general to represent them. Meanwhile, Republican U.S. Senate candidate John Deaton, along with a group of Massachusetts residents, has filed a similar lawsuit under a century-old state law to prevent the unlawful expenditure of public funds by the Massachusetts legislature. DeZoglio has been gaining public support in her efforts to carry out the audit. Most recently, from retired Massachusetts trial court Judge Carol Erskine, now working as a media consultant and contributor. Erskine posted a fiery message to social media in defense of DeZoglio, slamming former colleagues in the trial and appeals courts for recently taking this position that state courts are not subject to audits. Not just as the state legislature has done since the audit was approved by voters. DeZoglio's legal efforts have also gained national media attention, with the state auditor appearing on Fox News Saturday in America program earlier this month to discuss a recent lawsuit. Not only has the attorney general not represented the interests of the 72% of the voters who overwhelmingly approved this audit, but she has actively fought against enforcing this law, DeZoglio said. She added, now the attorney general's motion to strike on behalf of Speaker Ron Mariano and Senate President Karen Spilka clearly shows she's an adversary not only to my only office, but most disappointingly, an adversary to the public interest her office is statutorily obligated to represent. The Herald has requested comment from Campbell's office. All right. On page 3. Excuse me. We have from Burlington a 2-alarm fire. Injures resident, entire condo buildings displaced. Firefighters battle flames amid snow, ice, and cluttered conditions. By Aaron Curtis. An individual was hospitalized with burns and residents of 8 units were displaced after a fire broke out on the second floor of the Hallmark Gardens on Tuesday. In addition to flames, firefighters battled deep snow, ice, and freezing temperatures while knocking down the 2-alarm blaze, which remains under investigation, according to the Burlington Fire Department. Crews received a 911 call at about 5:50 p.m. about a possible structure fire at 1 Hallmark Gardens, which is part of a condominium community. Engine 4 arrived to find flames erupting from a second-floor unit. All residents had already evacuated, allowing crews to stretch 2 hose lines to the second floor while additional firefighters ventilated the roof. According to the department, firefighters treated 1 resident who suffered burns. They were later transported to a local hospital for further treatment. The department released video footage from the scene showing the fire leaping from the second story window. Despite clutter inside the affected unit, and hydrants that needed to be cleared of snow from the weekend's monster storm, firefighters contained the blaze to 1 unit where it started. and had it under control in about 30 minutes. The 8-unit building sustained significant damage. Smoke spread throughout the second floor, and water damage affected the first floor units below. All residents were displaced, though the total number of people affected and the level of assistance they will need are still being assessed, the department said. Mutual aid companies from Bedford, Lexington, Woburn, Wilmington assisted at the scene, while Armstrong Ambulance kept an ambulance on standby. Fire departments from Billerica, Reading, Stoneham covered Burlington stations during the incident. We have two bird stories here. Who's out there? Wachusett's Meadow Wildlife to host Family Owl Prowl, February 28, Princeton. Families are invited to discover the secret world of owls during a Family Owl Prowl from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on Saturday, February 28th at Wachusett's Meadow Wildlife Sanctuary at 113 Goodnow Road. This time of year, local owls are especially vocal as they establish territory and communicate with their mates, making late winter one of the best seasons to hear their distinctive calls. The program begins with a hands-on indoor introduction where participants will learn about owl behavior, adaptations, and identification. Families will then head outdoors for a short evening hike to listen and look for owls and other nighttime wildlife who might be nearby. The program is designed for families with children ages 5 and up. For more information or to register, visit massaudubon.org. And a longer story about birds, birds of a feather. This is from Fitchburg. Chestnut-collared longspurred draws birders to Fitchburg Airport. Hundreds of ornithophiles have flocked to the Fitchburg Municipal Airport since word got out about a rare species of bird discovered there. John Skinner was the first to spot a chestnut-colored longspur there back in December. The Leominster resident said it's unusual to see the grassland species here, whose range is typically restricted to central western states, Texas, Colorado, Montana, and the Dakotas. There's only been 5 previous records of the bird showing up in Massachusetts, and it's the first time it's ever been reported in Worcester County, he said of the special occasion. Folks from all over New England have come to see the bird. There's been over 380 reports submitted to the eBird website, and I estimate over 400 people have probably come to see the bird. What's even more unusual is that the chestnut-collared longspur is still hanging out at the airport, much to the delight of fellow bird enthusiasts who have enjoyed watching the small ground-feeding bird that, according to Wikipedia, primarily eats seeds and breeds in prairie habitats in Canada and the northern United States and winters to the south in the United States and Mexico. Skinner relayed that the airport is a great spot to go birding, especially for birds that like open grassland habitats. In the winter, there's usually species like horned larks, snow buntings, and Lapland longspurs, which were all the birds I was hoping to see the day I found the chestnut-collared longspur, he said. When he first spotted it on the morning of December 4th, it was pretty far out on the tarmac, and although Skinner couldn't see it very well, he immediately knew it wasn't one of the species listed above. This time of year, when birds aren't in their breeding plumage, there's an extra challenge when some species look so similar, he said. I was able to get good enough pictures of a few key field marks, like the black belly and wide white patches on the tail, which made me start thinking it was a chestnut-colored longspur. Sent photos of a couple of birding friends for their thoughts, including fellow Massachusetts Rare Bird Alert Discord group moderator, Max Chafin Jacobs, and everyone agreed it was indeed a chestnut-colored longspur. I sent out an alert to the group, and I think that there were half a dozen other birders at the airport within the hour, Skinner said of the online group that has over 800 members. Word spreads fast when a bird this rare shows up. When asked why he thinks the chestnut-colored longspur has remained at the airport for so long and for what reasons it is in an area where it typically isn't, the seasoned birder broke it down. Birds that show up outside of the ranges are called vagrants, and we don't know exactly why they wander like this, Skinner said. It's possible that the bird's ability to navigate is faulty, so it wandered eastward when it should have gone south. It's also possible that this bird is exploring and could be making an effort to expand the species range. Sometimes due to habitat loss or overcrowding, birds can try to expand their range to find new regions and less competition. Nonetheless, he said, it is very exciting that it decided to stick around for so long, as previous reports of the same species in our state don't have them here for more than 1 or 2 days. The airport with the large fields is likely very similar to its preferred habitats within its typical range, Skinner said. Also, several people have put down bird seed at the edge of the parking lot, which I'm sure has encouraged it to stick around. It has become very habitual and seems to hang out in the same spot where the seed is almost all day long. Like so many others, he was drawn to nature and the outdoors when the pandemic hit. I first got interested in birding in the spring of 2020. I've always been curious about birds, and it felt like a great way to spend time outside during the pandemic, he said. Skinner and Chalfin Jacobs first met in person during the winter of 2022 when they were both doing the annual Nantucket Christmas bird count, but they knew each other before that due to having mutual friends. We have birded with each other on Nantucket and the Cape over the years, and last, when he came to see the longspur at the airport, Skinner said. After Skinner sent him photos of the unknown longspur with the theory that it was a chestnut-collared, Chalfin Jacobs looked at the photos with a couple of friends. We concluded with John that the extent of white on the tail and the dark coloration on the belly eliminated all but the chestnut-collared longspur, Chalfin Jacobs said, an incredible find by John. The Newton resident travels to the airport on December 11th to see it himself and also take pictures of it. It was quite cooperative, and I slowly approached, photographed the bird for about 20 minutes, and then cautiously backed up so as not to disturb the bird, which was feeding throughout, Chalfin Jacobs said, of his first interactions with the chestnut-colored longspur. He's been birding 17 years and started doing bird photography about 7 years ago. I was always a kid encouraged to spend time outdoors, he said. I fell in love with nature first and then specifically birds when I was about 5. I loved seeing such exciting and colorful animals in my backyard and beyond. Since then, my passion for birds and birding has only increased. Chalfin Jacobs reported that as of Tuesday, February 24th, the chestnut-colored longspur is still calling the Fitchburg Municipal Airport home, having survived the blizzard. His birding friend Skinner shared that when he sees this bird, he's much amazed by how much effort it must have taken to get here. I wonder how it decided to stop at this small airport, and I'm amazed how cooperative it has been so that so many people have been able to come and see it and enjoy it, Skinner said. Chalfin Jacobs echoed the sentiments. I very much agree with John about the excitement and joy that comes from discovering and observing new birds and wild things around you, he said. I have been birding in Massachusetts since I was 5 years old, and this is a species I've never seen before in my life. Just a short drive away, there are beautiful birds all around us all the time. All you have to do, take some time to get out there and look for them. When I'm out, Skinner said it's the same for him. When I'm out birding, I enjoy the fact that there's always something new to discover. Whether that's seeing or hearing a familiar bird do something different finding a rare bird like this. Being able to enjoy and experience birds has expanded my enjoyment of the natural world in very rewarding ways. And I think most other birders feel the same. When asked what their favorite bird is and why, Chalfin Jacobs answered right off the bat. My favorite bird is the American Dipper, a bird from the western United States, he said. They are small little gray birds about the size of a cardinal, but they dive into rapid streams to eat small fish and various other invertebrates, which I think is super cool and unique. Plus, I love the mountain habitats and streams where you might encounter them. Skinner said that while it's hard to pick just one of his favorite types of birds are shrikes, who have a broad global range across the northern hemisphere. In the winter, we sometimes get northern shrikes coming down from Canada and northern New England, he said. They're the size of American robin, but they eat rodents and other small birds. They're small but tough little birds. There are 34 species of shrikes worldwide, and I hope I can get to see more of them. He encourages people to go see the chestnut-colored longspur at the airport and recommends staying at least 30 feet away from it so it doesn't get flushed. It has been seen almost every day that it's been here, and lately it's been consistently visiting the same spot at the edge of the airport parking lot near three plastic yellow poles across from the main office building, Skinner said. It isn't very skittish, so if you bring a pair of binoculars, you should be able to get extremely good looks. He went on to say that if people are interested in getting into birding, there isn't a better time to start, with spring right around the corner, and share the names of some of the bird clubs in the area. Athol Bird and Nature Club, Worcester Forbush Bird Club, Brookline Bird Club, the largest and one of the oldest bird clubs in Massachusetts. Skinner wrapped up his thoughts on the excitement of being the one to discover and seeing a chestnut-colored longspur in the city by thanking their host. I want to express gratitude to the airport's manager for allowing birders to access the parking lot and areas around the parking lot, he said. I haven't heard of any complaints from the airport staff about all these birders showing up and crowding the parking lot. And the 5-minute read from Lowell. Home heating assistance. The Massachusetts Home Energy Assistance Program is a free resource offered by Community Teamwork Incorporated in partnership with the State Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities to help eligible households pay a portion of winter heating bills. No matter what type of heating source you have, HEAP may be able to help you pay your winter heating bills. The HEAP application is free. Even if HEAP is included in the cost of your rent, you may still be eligible for home energy assistance. HEAP provides assistance for all sources of heat, including oil, electricity, natural gas, propane, kerosene, wood, and coal. Upon approval, payments are made directly to your heating company. If your household qualifies for HEAP, you will be automatically protected from shutoff for the duration of the winter moratorium, which runs through April 1st. Homeowners and renters, including households whose cost of heat is included in the rent, can apply for HEAP. Eligibility is based on the household size and the gross annual income of every household member, 18 years of age and older. Household income cannot exceed 60% of estimated state median income. If you are not eligible for HEAP or another low income program, you'll need to submit a financial hardship form to your utility company to receive this protection. For more information on this utility program, contact your utility provider. CTI's Fuel Assistance Program serves the cities and towns of Arlington, Bedford, Belmont, Billerica, Burlington, Carlisle, Chelmsford, Dracut, Dunstable, Groton, Lexington, Lowell, Pepperell, Tewksbury, Tyngsborough, Waltham, Watertown, Westford, and Wilmington. Save the date. Alzheimer's Concert Benefit. Chelmsford, the 15th annual A Night on the Edge takes place Saturday, March 21st at 7 p.m. at the Chelmsford Elks Hall, 300 Littleton Road. North Andover native Michelle Canning and her Michelle Canning Band host an Alzheimer's benefit concert in honor of her grandfather who lived with the disease. Tickets are $25 for adults or $15 for children 12 and under. To purchase, visit michellecanning.net. To date, the concert benefit has raised more than $95,000 for Alzheimer's Foundation of America. Proceeds help fund AFA programs and services nationwide, which include a national toll-free helpline, the National Memory Screening Program, therapeutic and educational programs, caregiver support groups, professional training, as well as research towards better treatment and cure. March's benefit hopes to surpass the $100,000 mark. This year's show features Canning's song, Better Left Unsaid, written about a family's experience with Alzheimer's, which she will perform in front of a slideshow featuring dozens of pictures submitted by audience members, bandmates, and donors of their loved ones affected by Alzheimer's. Canning welcomes photo submissions, which can be sent to info@michellecanning.net up to 1 week before the show. Currently, more than 135,000 people in Massachusetts live with the Alzheimer's disease. Nationwide, it's approximately 7 million Americans. I'm thrilled to celebrate the 15th anniversary of A Night on the Edge, Canning said. For the past 15 years, it has been a pleasure to watch this event grow from a small fundraiser to a space where music and community come together to help families affected by Alzheimer's disease. It is truly an honor to raise funds for the Alzheimer's Foundation of America as they provide care and resources for Alzheimer's patients, families, and caregivers. And Larry Summers will resign from teaching, Harvard says, by Colin Blinkley. Former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers will resign from teaching at Harvard University as campus reviews his ties to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, the university announced Wednesday. Summers, who has been on leave since November and whose names appeared hundreds of times in the newly released Epstein files, will step down at the end of the school year, according to statement from Harvard spokesperson Jason Newton. Professor Summers has announced that he will retire from his academic and faculty appointments at Harvard at the end of this academic year and will remain on leave until that time, Newton said. In his statement, Summers said it was a difficult decision and he expressed gratitude to the students and colleagues he worked with over 50 years, including five as Harvard's president. Free of formal responsibility as president emeritus and a retired professor, I look forward in time to engaging in research, analysis, and commentary on a range of global economic issues, Summers said. Justice Department latest release has rippled through academia, uncovering Epstein's ties to numerous researchers who sought his funding and his friendship even after he became a convicted sex offender. Summers' resignation follows that of Dr. Richard Axel, a Nobel laureate, who on Tuesday announced he would step down as co-director of Columbia University's Zuckerman Mind Brain Behavior Institute. Summers served as Treasury Secretary under former President Bill Clinton and went on to lead Harvard for 5 years starting in 2001. Trove files released by government cast new light on Summers' relationship with Epstein, which spanned years and included visits to one another at their homes in Massachusetts and New York. The two traded emails on topics ranging from politics, economy, to women and romance. Summers, who has been married for 20 years, consulted Epstein on a separate relationship with a woman he was tutoring in his economics, according to emails from 2018 to 2019. Epstein described himself as Summers' wingman and encouraged persistence. 2018 email, Summers said the woman was never his student, but he had known her father for 20 years as a Chinese economic official. I have a very good life with Lisa, kids, etc., Summers said in a 2018 email referencing his wife. Easy to put at risk for something that might not materialize at all, or if it does, might prove transient. In 2016 email, Summers appears to use a slur for Asian people while discussing an upcoming meeting between Epstein and an official from a Chinese university. Responding to previous revelations, Summers last year said he had great regrets in my life and that his association with Epstein was a major error in judgment. Harvard officials have publicly said little about Summers' relationship. When Summers went on leave last year, the university said it was reviewing individuals at Harvard who were in the Epstein documents to evaluate what actions may be warranted. Epstein's ties to Harvard were the focus of a 2020 campus report finding that the finance gave more than $9 million to the Ivy League school, mostly for a center founded by math and biology professor Martin Nowak. Yet the report did not mention Summers' relationship with Epstein. Nowak was later disciplined by Harvard. In December, Summers was dealt a lifetime ban from the American Economic Association, a nonprofit scholarly association dedicated to economic research, over his Epstein ties. He has also left the board of directors at OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT. At Columbia, Axel said in a statement Tuesday that he regretted his association with Epstein, calling it a serious error in judgment. He said he is also giving up his position as an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, but will continue to research and teach in his laboratory at the Zuckerman Institute in Manhattan. Axel was one of the 2004 winners of a Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discoveries related to the human olfactory system. His name appears on more than 600 times in the Justice Department files reviewed by the Associated Press, including in emails exchanged with Epstein and on a schedule noting their meetings, dinners, and lunches. In news article published in 2007, while Epstein was initially under investigation in Florida, the scientists praised Epstein's intellect, telling New York Magazine, "He has the ability to make connections that other minds can't make. He's extremely smart and probing." The resignations are the latest fallout from the Justice Department's recent release of millions of pages of records pertaining to Epstein and his longtime confidant and former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell. Resignations have ripped across academia, legal, and business communities. In Britain, former Prince Andrew and ex-diplomat Peter Mandelson were arrested because of their connections to Epstein and Maxwell. What about Donald Trump's relationship with Epstein? All right, here we go. From the editorial page, we have bad economic policy isn't necessarily unconstitutional by Clive Crook from the Bloomberg opinion page. He is a Bloomberg opinion columnist and member of the editorial board covering economics. Previously, he was deputy editor of The Economist and chief Washington commentator for the Financial Times. U.S. politics is apt to conflate disagreements about whether a policy is good or bad with disputes about whether it's constitutional. Reactions to the Supreme Court's ruling on President Trump's tariffs are a good example. Most commentators seem to be drawn to one of two positions. The tariffs are either bad policy and an abuse of president power, or good policy and constitutionally proper. Yet the criteria in question have little to do with each other. I think Trump's tariffs are foolish, a reckless repudiation of tried and tested economics that jeopardizes America's stunning economic strengths. But set that aside. Why exactly is this policy, smart or stupid, as the case may be, illegal? The court has ruled against the bulk of Trump's tariffs on what seems a narrow technicality. According to the majority's ruling, the statute purportedly authorizing the administration's signature policy, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, lets the White House regulate trade under certain circumstances, but precludes tariffs as a way to carry out that regulatory function. Notice the word tariff never appears in the statute, says the majority. fly specking the history of IEEPA and related laws. As always, Justice Neil Gorsuch is an excellent read on such matter. Raises doubts about whether Congress intended regulate to include tariffs, and as a matter of constitutional law, this connection needs to be clear for the policy to comply. My problem with the pivotal finding that regulate doesn't encompass tariffs is its apparent absurdity, rarely something that concerns the best legal minds. Whatever Congress might or might not have meant, to deny the tariffs are a way to regulate trade is absurd. Regulating trade is what tariffs are for. Would the majority deny that carbon taxes regulate emissions of carbon and that highway tolls regulate the flow of traffic? Like tariffs, they are taxes whose purpose is to regulate. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, dissenting along with Justice Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, outlines the point. Does the majority think the administration can respond to a qualifying emergency with straightforward tools of regulation, such as import quotas or punitive local content requirements, voluntary export restraints, or any such barrier, however ill-conceived or self-defeating, so long as it isn't also a tax? A total ban on imports could also be lawful in qualifying emergency under IEEPA. But a 5% tariff is executive overreach? It's a tad paradoxical. Though the majority organized itself around the finding that tariffs don't regulate, 170 pages of splintered opinions and dissents touch in many other constitutional ambiguities and uncertainties, few of which this ruling settles, and many of which will resurface as litigation over Trump's ever-shifting trade policies advances. For a start, there's a question of refunds. The ruling offers no guidance on whether importers who have paid unlawful tariffs should expect restitution, or how any such scheme should be administered. Regardless of how the administration decides to proceed, there will be new legal challenges and protracted confusion. The president immediately proposed a new universal tariff, so much for reciprocity, under a different statutory authority, plus investigations that might lead to country-by-country tariffs under yet others. Unlike IEEPA, these laws cover tariffs, but other questions arise. Will Trump's new measures be deemed so radical or unprecedented that they implicate the court's major questions doctrine, which demands more explicit congressional authorization? How far, statute by statute, has Congress already delegated its tariff-setting power? And what limits does the Constitution impose on such delegations? Last week's ruling ignores what strikes this non-lawyer as the most important separation of powers question at all. So far as trade policy is concerned, when Congress delegates setting of tariffs to the executive because of an emergency, what exactly does emergency mean? Who decides? And subject to what checks and balances? If declaring an emergency, even for a limited time, is deemed to be exclusively the president's call because trade policy is foreign policy or according to some other rationale, then what's to stop the White House continuously declaring emergency after emergency for any reason it chooses? Some emergencies from the 1970s, are still in effect. Asked to rule on these and other trade policy matters, the court will doubtless tell us more about what the Constitution means. My own preference, if I were drafting a new charter, would be to a distribution of powers that puts the White House firmly in the lead on tariffs, merely because they require complex international negotiations that put legislatures, so to speak, at a comparative disadvantage. But here's the main thing. My preferred distribution of powers has nothing to do whatsoever with my preferential policy. Sum it up this way. Worry about whether Trump's policies are wise as well as they're constitutional. Two separate questions. Don't ask the Constitution to tame a reckless president supported by a cravenly acquiescent Congress. The only remedy for that is elections. And from the Lowell Sun, latest nor'easter can't compare to the blizzard of 78. As some southeastern Massachusetts communities and the state of Rhode Island still try to dig out for Monday's nor'easter, many have drawn comparisons to the standard by which all the region's snowstorms are measured, the blizzard of 78. These two blockbuster winter storms certainly share some characteristics, include hurricane force wind gusts and relentless snowstall, and both descended on the area on a Monday, February 6th in 78. Coincidentally, both were preceded by a significant snowstorm just a few weeks prior. Coastal communities in both instances took the brunt of these two ocean behemoths due to a wind-fueled tidal storm surge. Like Monday's storm, isolated locations in the 78 blizzard received higher snow totals with as much as 40 inches recorded on Plymouth County. On average, that 1978 storm deposited about 27 inches of snow on the area, 27.1 inches in Boston, 27.6 in Providence. Records at the time indicated Lowell received anywhere from 24 to 30 inches of the white stuff. Though our just concluded nor'easter certainly wreaked havoc on certain communities, the devastating effects of the 78 blizzard were more widespread. Fury of our recent nor'easter relented by Monday evening, but the 78 storm pummeled the region for 35 consecutive hours, seemingly stationary menace that continued to spew an endless stream of snow and high winds. The huge technological strides made in the intervening 48 years also contributed to the widely different levels of preparation for those two powerful weather events. Unlike today, the 1978 storm's devastation was amplified by rudimentary weather forecasting and a lack of instant communication. The internet didn't exist. There were no weather alerts sent to non-existent smartphone or 24/7 cable news networks. Mass DOT only received periodic updates from the National Weather Service over a teletype machine. That contributed to the storm's devastating effect. It seemingly arrived on our doorstep with little advanced warning. By the time snow actually began in earnest, it was far too late for the last-minute preparations. Weather forecasts at the time suggested a blizzard that struck the Midwest could meet a tropical storm heading up from the southern coast, covering the area in snow on that Monday morning. But when morning came without any precipitation, skeptical New Englanders treated the workday like business as usual. By the time the realization of the storm's severity finally sank in, countless commuters clogged the highways by early afternoon in a frantic rush to get home before blizzard conditions made that impossible. Unfortunately, the storm soon made even major highways impassable. Rather than running the risk of staying in their cars in the hopes of assistance, motorists simply left their vehicles and walked to safety. By the time then-Governor Michael Dukakis, wearing what would become a signature cardigan wool sweater, declared a state of emergency, the storm was cranking. The state's interstate highways were shut down for a week, along with local driving bans. Recovery efforts received significant help from the National Guard, who often manned checkpoints to keep non-essential workers off the roads, and it cost hundreds of millions in $1978. Another stark difference were the deaths attributed to the two storms. As of this writing, at least 5 deaths have been attributed to this nor'easter, 2 in Maryland from a falling tree, 1 for carbon monoxide poisoning in Rhode Island, 2 in a storm-related motor vehicle accident in Pennsylvania. Blizzard of 78, by contrast, accounted for over 100 deaths across the entire East Coast. Some deaths were attributed to carbon monoxide poisoning, as people stranded in their cars left the engines running to keep them warm and snow piled up around them. But none were more tragic than the ill-fated rescue attempt by a crew of the 49-foot pilot boat Can Do. It left Gloucester Harbor on February 6th to assist a 44-foot Coast Guard cutter that had lost power and radar while trying to aid the oil tanker Global Hope off the coast of Salem. The Can-Do, rocked by a large wave, lost radar, and ultimately sank with all crew members, Frank Quirk Jr., Donald Wilkinson, Norman Curley, and Ken Fuller, losing their lives. The National Weather Service compiled these significant Blizzard of 78 statistics. Snowfall, starting late February 5th, hit hard as February 6th, continued until February 7th. Duration, 35 hours and 40 minutes. Snowfall totals, 1 to 3 feet. Deaths in Massachusetts, 73. Blizzard-related injuries or illnesses, 4,324. Cars stranded on Route 128, 3,000. Trucks stranded on Route 128, 500. Typical hurricane speed, 74 miles an hour. Top wind gusts in Boston, 79 miles an hour. Favorite media blizzard blurb, the week the state stood still. How long the state stood still, February 6th to 13th. We don't dispute the ferocity of Monday's blizzard, with the hazards faced, and still being faced by countless individuals, homeowners, and businesses. But it's obviously which unique, frightening weather event had the greater grip on the region. And from the sports section of the Lowell Sun, some local stories. Arlington Catholic heats up in time. Cougars snap skid, skate past Chelmsford in style, 4-1. Once by Tom Mullerin. Once the hottest team in Division I, a four-game skid to close the regular season had the Arlington Catholic boys hockey team trending in the wrong direction, heading into a loaded state tournament field. Consider it unfazed. With a 4-1 win over 19-seeded Chelmsford in a Division I first-round matchup Wednesday night, the number 14 Cougars, 16-6-1, pieced together much of what anchored a 15-game unbeaten streak in the regular season. Four different players scored, including one on a power play. Sparks of energy fueled game-winning plays throughout. The penalty kill was tasked a concerning 7 times, but 6 skills behind freshman Steve Kimara's 24 saves and Arlington Catholic's typical dose of physicality ensured it continued its season. A rematch with number 3 St. John's prep team that started their skid is next for the Cougars in the second round on Saturday at 3:20. After losing to St. John's Prep, we had a couple cracks that opened up. Winning hides all that stuff, said Arlington Catholic head coach Kurt Colarudo. We had a little bit of a skid, but we came back and had some really good practices. The boys worked hard. We kind of got it back a little bit. I thought we played very well tonight. Took just 2 minutes and 15 seconds for the Cougars to hit the reset button, generating a goal from its third line for an early lead. Defenseman Sam Matthews' breakout pass was tipped in the neutral zone by Connor Keough, ahead to freshman Landon Masters in the offensive zone, and he sniped the top far corner for a 1-0 advantage from the right circle. That was exactly the kind of tone center the Arlington Catholic aimed for. Understanding the urgency at hand. Everyone was just working. Everybody wanted it, said senior co-captain Tyler Heldenberg. We go out there. We have a great first shift. Everybody's hitting, banging bodies, a lot of good stuff like that. A lot of block shots. This was our last home game here. It meant something to us. We all wanted to win. Arlington Catholic handled his first penalty kill with ease, generating 3 short hand quality shots. that Will McNeil, 34 saves, denied to keep it a 1-0 deficit for Chelmsford. He couldn't stop a 2-0 deficit a few minutes later, though, as Braden Bosnowski tipped in a shot from Steven Constantine at the point. Penalties continued to rack up for the Cougars after Hellenberg's goal early in the second gave them a 3-0 lead and finally bit them on John Rossetti's goal to cut the deficit to 3-1. Otherwise, Camaro was excellent in helping kill off the other six penalties as well as 41 seconds of 5-on-3. He's awesome. I love him, Heldenberg said. He's the backbone of our team, really. After losing a guy like All-Scholastic Pat Clare, it's hard to find a goalie to be the guy and to bail you out in certain situations. He's definitely our guy. Didn't even take 2 minutes for Arlington Catholic to get that goal back, sparked by Bosnowski's physicality. He hunted down big hits in each of the three zones, punctuated by one at the boards in the defensive zone that set up Constantine for a breakaway goal and a 4-1 lead. At any given moment, anyone on this team can give us some energy, Conorello said. He gave us energy all over the ice. That lifts the team. That lifts the line for sure. That would appear to be it from the Lowell Sun. And let's see what we have here in the Eagle Tribune. Okay, from the Eagle Tribune, Thursday, February 26th, from the front page, we have several stories. Start with Made in Merrimack Valley. Orchestra, concert, grand piano come together. North Andover. Two pillars of classical music, an orchestra and a concert grand piano, will come together on Rogers Center stage at 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. They will power a powerful Merrimack Valley Philharmonic Orchestra concert teeming with local ties, including the piano itself. The top-of-the-line CC grand piano at 9 feet 4 inches, the size of a horse, was built from the ground up in Haverhill, home to Mason & Hamlin Piano Company, a legacy American manufacturer. Company artist-in-resident Oscar Jang will play Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2, a renowned piece the Russian-American composer performed a century ago on his piano of choice, a Mason & Hamlin, during his first concert tour in America. The Philharmonic's 70-string woodwind brass percussion players come from Merrimack Valley, including Andover, North Andover, Haverhill, Lawrence, and Methuen. Conducting them will be David Feltner, a composer and violist who has performed with the Boston Symphony Orchestra and serves as the Boston Pops backup conductor for Keith Lockhart. Sunday's legendary classics concert at Merrimack College's Art Center, part of the Philharmonic's 65th anniversary celebration, will strike notes and chords that stir listeners' ears. It's going to be some of the core classical pieces that everybody knows in their head. We're doing Beethoven's Fifth, we're doing the New World Symphony by Dvorak, and Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2. The Haverhill-made piano, which sells for more than $200,000, will be a centerpiece of the nearly 39-minute Rachmaninoff concerto. Violinist Jennifer Onello of North Andover has been with the MVPO since the 1990s. She says the orchestra wanted something spectacular for its 65th season and brought together Jang and the Mason Hamlin. He wowed the audience playing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue at the Philharmonic's fall concert kicking off the 65th season. Onello had first heard Jang play the Mason and Hamlin when it arrived for the orchestra's final rehearsal. She listened from the back of the auditorium and the music reached her emotionally. I couldn't believe my eyes, ears, Onello said. The brightness, the tones were vibrant and shining in the room. The orchestra rarely shares a stage with a piano soloist in maybe 5% of its concerts. Jiang said combining two major formats of classical music, the orchestra and the piano, is a fusion work that demands a piano with a presence. Mason & Hamlin's CC Piano, the largest production model made in the Americas, has an astounding depth of power and resonance and rises to each occasion, he said. The ability of this piano to match the orchestra in those most dramatic moments when the orchestra is really going at it in terms of excitement, Jiang said. It also responds just as well as in the softer moments. The notes sing, sweet and deep and sustained, said Jiang, whose first musical memory is plinking a toy keyboard at age 4. The native Australian earned his undergraduate degree at Juilliard School in New York City and master's at the New England Conservatory in Boston. Jiang has performed internationally on stages from London to Paris to Taichung, Taiwan, and Melbourne, Australia, as well as New York's Lincoln Center and Boston's Jordan Hall. He feels a historic connection playing his piece on the Mason and Hamlin. The Rachmaninoff Concerto is one of the pinnacles of the late Romantic compositions. Critics observed how it lifted audience with its poetry, warmth, and buoyant creative power. Pianos were a mainstay in American homes in the early 20th century before radio and recorded music took hold and the rising popularity of the guitar. In 1923, almost 350,000 pianos were sold in the United States when the population was a third of what it is today, according to census and consumer data. Martin and Hamlin and Steinway and Sons pianos were prestigious in demand. Today, less than 20,000 pianos are sold annually. In the United States. Wow. Today less than 20,000. I hope I read that right. 20,000 acoustic pianos are sold annually in the United States. As of 2021, Mason Hamlin, in its tall red brick mill building where shoes were once made, employed several dozen people and sold about 100 pianos a year. It produces 6 models ranging from upright to grand, about 4 feet long to 9 feet 4 inches. Mason and Hamlin and Steinway's Sons are two of the last 2 to 3 piano manufacturers left in the nation. It's fitting that for the MVPO to celebrate its 65th with Mason and Hamlin made 10 miles away in Haverhill. The Merrimack Valley Orchestra was started in August 1961 by Joseph Lerardi and other musically minded engineers from the Raytheon Company in Andover. From its humble beginnings, it has grown to an orchestra with a revolving membership of 100 musicians, including 20 violinists. On Sunday, the orchestra will be joined by a piano with a big American sound played by a recognized virtuoso. Yang has a simple goal in mind for Sunday. Sundays, I'm hoping that we can give the audience just a really good time. Sunday's legendary classics concert at Merrimack College's Art Center, part of the Philharmonic 65th anniversary celebration, will strike notes and chords listeners' ears. Sounds like quite a show. And in Andover, Andover voters, town seeks support for e-bike registry. A home rule petition and bylaw amendment to establish an electric bicycle registry has a recommendation the select board heading to vote at town meeting in April. Select board unanimously supported the town meeting article at its Monday meeting. The article was requested by Police Chief Patrick Keefe. Its goal is to promote public safety when using e-bikes in town, assist in finding lost or stolen bikes, and create accountability for those operating them through Andover. The article, if passed, would authorize the select board to petition the Massachusetts General Court for special legislation that would give the town permission to create an e-bike registry. The town would then enact a bylaw providing structure to the registration in the form of a home rule. The police department would enforce the bylaw and use its discretion when somebody violates it. The bylaw would need to be approved by the Attorney General before it goes into effect. Electric bikes fall under different classifications. E-bikes are equipped with motors that assist a rider pedaling and stop assisting when the bike reaches 20 miles per hour with an electric motor of 750 watts or less, according to Mass Bike. Massachusetts doesn't have an age restriction as to who can operate an e-bike, and its operator doesn't need a license or registration. However, those under 16 are required to wear a helmet in compliance with U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission standards. All users of e-bikes and bicycles are required to follow the same rules as cars. They need to stop at red lights and stop signs and use hand signals when turning. E-bikes are not allowed on sidewalks, and passengers can't ride on them unless the e-bike is equipped with a seat for an extra rider. The police department created a task force last summer to make sure e-bike operators were following road rules after receiving numerous daily complaints. Concerns about e-bikes include how easily they are to modify and ones that are more like a motorized bike or moped. E-bike registry would provide a platform for safety and awareness on their use, Select Board Chair Alex Vespoli said. And a registry would better assist the police department in developing an inventory of what bikes are in town and what should be insured and operated like a motor vehicle. The registry would be an official record maintained by the department concerning ownership details, serial numbers, and proof of registration issued by Andover. It would also assist the police department recovery efforts. As Keith said, there have been some issues with lost and stolen e-bikes. The registry would make it easier to identify a bike's owner. The registry would provide an opportunity to engage and educate the public about e-bikes and safety. The free registry would require a renewal of registration every 3 years. It would additionally be used as a tool to make sure kids and adults operating them know the rules of the road and stress how these bikes should be modified. Keith said there is value in knowing who owns e-bikes in towns while also educating their operators on what happens when speeds pass the limit. He said the bikes are expensive and theft of them has become rampant. Board member Melissa Danish said the town may also want to consider how to handle the delivery services who pick up items in town and if they should also register their e-bikes. Town would want residents who use bikes as a mode of transportation to register the e-bikes within 30 days of moving to town, buying a bike, or knowing they will use it as a mode of transportation within or through Andover often. They would also seek people to register their bikes who pass through Andover on a regular basis or commute to work in town on them. Visitors who are in Andover for less than 14 consecutive days would be exempt. And we also have local story from Lawrence, Glenn, and others to receive Hibernian Awards. The president of Northern Essex Community College is one of the three Greater Lawrence men who will be honored by Hibernians during the upcoming Irish month of March. Lane Glenn has been selected as this year's recipient of the Honorable John E. Fenton Citizenship Award. Members of the Reverend James T. O'Reilly OSA Division 8 Ancient Order of Hibernians announced. The award recognizes Glenn's outstanding contributions to the region. Dan Halloran, Program Director of the Lawrence Family Development Lawrence Prospera, has been selected as a 2026 recipient of the Richard Cardinal Cushing Award. Joseph Sipsey of Methuen, a 40-year plus member of Division AAOH, was named the Irishman of the Year, the highest award of the local Hibernians can bestow on a member, AOH member spokesperson Bill Sullivan said. Hibernians are dedicated to promoting Irish culture, community service, and true Christian charity. The Reverend James T. O'Reilly, OSA, Division 8, AOH, in Lawrence was founded in 1871. The Fenton Award will be presented at the annual St. Patrick's Day luncheon on Friday, March 13th at the Lawrence Lodge of Elks, 652 Andover Street. Halloran and Sipsey will receive their awards at the 154th annual St. Patrick's Day banquet and dance on March 7th at the Elks Lodge. The Honorable John E. Fenton Citizenship Award was established in 1975 to honor the late John Fenton, who passed in August 1974. Fenton, who was also a member of Division 8, went on to serve two terms as National President of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. Fenton Award honors a man, woman, or organization without regard to their religious or ethnic background who has contributed in an outstanding manner to the betterment of the Greater Lawrence and the Merrimack Valley area. The award was first awarded to late Irving E. Rogers, then publisher and owner of the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. The Richard Cardinal Cushing Award, named after the late Catholic Irish prelate who died in 1970, was first presented in 1974 to John F. McCormick, then Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. The award recognizes an Irish Catholic of high moral character who exemplifies the characteristics of Cushing. The individual may be a man or woman who, through their life, endeavors, demonstrates in their daily lives the qualities of what an exemplary Irish Catholic should be, Iberian said. The Irishman of the Year Award, which is the highest award the division can bestow on a member, was established in 1964 and is presented annually to member of Division 8 AOH for his outstanding service, dedication, and contributions to Hibernianism and Division 8. The first recipient of the award was late Patrick Scanlon of Lawrence. Congratulations to all those award winners. In Rockingham, across the border, districts accused of withholding departure details of staff members. Three school districts within Rockingham County have been accused by parents of withholding information related to the termination or removal of employees, fueling community concern, and in some cases, allegedly prompting police involvement. Timberlane Regional School District, Salem School District, and Derry Cooperative School District have each confirmed personnel actions involving staff members, but declined to release details, citing privacy laws. In multiple instances, parents have publicly alleged misconduct involving students. In Derry Cooperative School District, parents have alleged inappropriate touching involving a staff member. Though a case number was provided to the Eagle Tribune, neither the Derry Police Department nor the police district could confirm whether the investigation involves the staff member in question. The staffer, who allegedly worked at both the Gilbert H. Hood Middle School and West Running Brook School, is reportedly no longer with the school district, though Superintendent Michael Flynn did not return multiple requests for comment. Excuse me. However, Derry Police Captain John Breen confirmed that the investigation filed with the police department on February 19th involved five counts of simple assault. At the time of publication, no charges were filed. It's an active investigation, Breen said. Breen declined to comment, confirm whether the staff member is subject of the investigation. In a separate matter at Pinkerton Academy, math teacher Benjamin Curry is no longer employed at the school following allegations of inappropriate student interactions. Benjamin Curry no longer works for Pinkerton Academy in any capacity, Communications Director Julia Mitchell said. To maintain our legal and privacy obligations, we do not comment on personnel matters. In the Timberlane Regional School District, the recent resignation of a teacher, Jeffrey Pasco, and the administrative leave of Danville Elementary School Principal Jamie Parsons have continued to draw scrutiny from families. District officials have not disclosed the nature of investigations involving Pasco and Parsons or confirmed if they are related, despite sexual misconduct allegations raised publicly by parents. Superintendent Justin Krieger was not immediately available for comment. As of publication, no criminal charges have been announced, and authorities have not confirmed any active investigation related to the personnel changes. In a separate matter within the district, another teacher was allegedly removed from the school and his name and photo removed from the school website without explanation from district officials to students' families. Plattsdale Police Chief John Santoro said the police department is not involved other than hearsay knowledge. We have no ongoing investigations or charges pending. In Salem, at Salem High School, a paraprofessional was escorted out of the building last week following what administrators described as a complaint involving a support staff member. Parents have alleged the staff member engaged in inappropriate misconduct involving several students, including meeting with them after school hours. Superintendent Maura Palmer said the administrators took immediate action upon receiving the complaint and clarified that the matter is not a criminal matter. The safety, security, and well-being of our students remain our highest priority, she said, adding the district uses comprehensive background checks and vetting in its hiring process. She declined further comment, citing personal privacy, did not identify the names of the support staff member. Salem Police Chief Joel Dolan said the matter did not rise to criminal involvement. If they thought even a hint of criminal wrongdoing, we'd have been the first they notified. Across the three districts, administrators have emphasized student safety while declining to discuss specific details about personnel actions. Parents continue to call for greater transparency when allegations involve school employees. That's it for page one. From Methuen, Brightbridge partners with Methuen High. Brightbridge Credit Union and Methuen High School came together on February 13th to host the annual Credit for Life Fair, an immersive financial literacy experience designed to prepare graduating seniors for life beyond high school. Held in the Klamath Fieldhouse at Methuen High School, the two-hour simulation challenged students to step into their future by selecting a career aligned with their postgraduate goals and receiving a projected salary. From here, students move through a series of interactive stations where they made realistic financial decisions they may soon face, including choices around higher education, housing, transportation, and everyday living expenses. The Credit for Life Fair remains a cornerstone of Methuen High School's commitment to preparing students for post-secondary success, Associate Principal Glenda Javier said. By experiencing firsthand the financial impact of their decisions, students left the event with strengthened financial literacy skills and increased confidence in their ability to make informed choices about their futures. Throughout the fair, students explored how lifestyle decisions such as dining out, joining a gym, or owning a pet can affect their monthly budget. They were also met with unexpected scenarios at the Wheel of Misfortune, where chance events tested their financial flexibility by introducing surprises that could either strain their budget or provide a financial boost. The experiences concluded at the credit counseling station, where volunteers reviewed each student's financial choices and helped connect the dots between incomes, expenses, and long-term planning. These one-on-one conversations reinforce the importance of budgeting and informed decision-making. Since its launch in 2018, the Credit for Life Fair has grown into a meaningful collaboration between Brightbridge and Methuen High School. The event is supported by dozens of volunteers from Brightbridge, the Methuen School District, and local professional and community organizations, all of whom bring real-world insight and guidance to the students. Hosting the Credit for Life Fair at the high school level is one of the most impactful ways we can prepare students for the realities of adulthood, Brightbridge marketing specialist and Credit for Life coordinator Olivia Pink said. By giving them a hands-on opportunity to create a budget, manage expenses, and make real-world financial decisions, we're equipping them with skills that extend far beyond the classroom. For the volunteers, the event was equally impactful as it provided opportunities to connect with local students about their post-college plans. It was so exciting to volunteer at this year's Credit for Life Fair and support students in the very community where I both live and work, Brightbridge Methuen's branch manager Lena Chiano said. Having candid conversations with graduating seniors about their goals and financial futures and guiding them through real-life scenarios makes this event especially rewarding. With a daughter of my own, it's a powerful reminder of how important it is to invest in the next generation. Brightbridge is a state-chartered community credit union with more than $2.4 billion in assets and headquartered in Lawrence. It serves about 124,000 members, primarily in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. Brightbridge operates 23 retail branches in Amesbury, Danvers, Haverhill, Lawrence, Methuen, North Andover, plus Plattsdale and Seabrook, New Hampshire, among others. And from New Hampshire, Manchester's Charlie Davis returns to the CBS series Survivor in season 50. Charlie Davis, who grew up in the seaside village. I'm sorry, this is in New Hampshire. This is Manchester by the Sea. Charlie Davis, who grew up in the seaside village of Manchester by the Sea, proved to be a formidable challenger on season 46 of CBS's Survivor, a half world away in Fiji, losing only at the last moment by 2 votes. But Davis has another chance to claim victory as he's one of the 24 returning players on a special Survivor 50 season, which kicked off Wednesday with a 3-hour opening episode. Obviously, I wanted to win, and I got really close, he said. When you can taste the win, the loss hurts that much more. And certainly, because I was about to graduate law school, I would have loved that $1 million prize for my student loans. Title of Sole Survivor comes with a $1 million prize for season 50. For those unfamiliar with the show, Survivor is a game of making alliances, of deceit and even lies, as each castaway works to maneuver his or her way to the top. In spite of the shifting relationships, many castaways leave their experience with new friends and new opportunities, as they are recognized by millions of viewers who tune in each week. Physical, mental, and emotional strength is required to survive the austere lifestyle living off the land during the competition. There are no creature comforts. During the show, the players go with little food, often just rice, sleep out in the elements, meaning cold and bugs, and experience whatever life on the island presents on any given day. They face weight loss, sleep deprivation, and extreme loss, and extreme stress inherent in the show. This time around, Davis, now 28, a third-year law student at Boston College, having earned an undergraduate degree from Harvard University. Or the first time around, Davis, now 28, was a third-year law student at Boston College, having earned an undergraduate degree from Harvard. He graduated 2 days after the conclusion of season 46, which aired in May 2024. I basically went straight from watching the finale and arrived back in Boston for my law school graduation. It was a lovely reception coming back to my friends and family. During the show, Davis said he appreciated the encouragement he received from locals. I felt a lot of love from the Cape Ann community throughout my time on Survivor, and I'm super grateful for all the support. I hope they bring it on again, he said. I hope the fans are super stoked for season 50. I think it'll be an awesome season and be ready to celebrate the epic history of the show. In spite of the hardship that comes with the show, he said there was no second guessing, an opportunity to compete again. There's an adrenaline associated with Survivor, a sort of energy, a thrill being out there, playing the game. It's really hard, but that's part of what draws you to it, the challenge. I wanted to go back out there, and I had some unfinished business. Plus, season 50 is a milestone of Survivor, the first returning players show since season 40. It's a huge, monumental season, Davis said. Part of it is being in the arena with all these former players, even a season 1 player. A former cross-country team captain, Davis knows about endurance and patience. A Survivor fan, he applied several years in a row to land a spot, a dream come true, he said in a previous interview. He was selected as one of 18 contestants for season 46, but only after a long interview and evaluation process. Davis returns to the game of Survivor as one of 24 players who will be divided up into 3 teams of 8. When asked about what trait would best serve as a player, Davis, now a practicing lawyer, said perhaps the ability to think clearly under stress. It's so much a culmination of your personality and the personality of the players you end up with. But if there was a quality I could pick, I would say it's being calm under pressure. If you're under a tight deadline and if you're too stressed out, you can't think properly. It's about being quick to adapt and quick to react. Despite the lack of basic comforts, Davis said the challenges are super fun. But season 50 has a new twist. The theme this time around is in the hands of the fans. In a video, Jeff Probst, host of the show, said the key to longevity of this game is players' ability to evolve and adapt. Survivor 50 is the next evolution of the game, Probst said. For the first time, the producers will not be in charge of the game design. The fans will. Fans will vote on all elements, from the colors chosen for game elements to what players will eat to where the finale will be held, on the South Pacific Island or back in Los Angeles. The players will have to play the game not knowing what's coming, Probst said. The big issue for the players is their lack of knowledge. It will be harder for players to make any assumptions based on their previous experiences. Survivor 50 cast features players from 11 states as well as Mexico and Winnipeg, Canada. Davis was selected to be on the Kalo tribe along with Tiffany, Erwin, Chrissy, Hoffbeck, Camilla, Carthage, Dee Villardes, Benjamin, Coach Wade, Mike White, and Jonathan Young. But Erwin is no stranger, as she and Davis were both on season 46. I played a lot of days on Survivor with Tiffany, Davis said, and there are pros and cons. At times we were at odds, and at times we worked together. Gloucester's James Jimmy T. Tarantino is familiar with strategizing that is inherent in the Survivor series because he was a contestant in 2010 in Nicaragua. Tarantino believed that Davis had outplayed everybody in season 46, but despite the outcome, he noted that Davis took the loss with grace. Davis had lost a key vote from the jury of eight, who decided the winner from among the final three. If it had been a tie vote, the outcome may have been different because a tiebreaker may have gone his way. Good luck. In Haverhill, celebration around the corner for Haverhill's 250th anniversary. There may not be any fireworks and flags overhead, but Haverhill's 250th program is underway. Haverhill's kicked off early programming to mark the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, opening the year-long celebration of the nation's founding and the city's roots in it. Festivities have already begun. The Buttonwoods Museum holding a colonial tea party last week. But next month, folks can turn to the Museum of Printing to learn more about a founding father. The new Benjamin Franklin exhibit will soon be shown to all visitors. Also, a lecture exploring press freedom and colonial resistance in the years leading up to independence will be showcased. Andrew Volpe will present Printing Revolution from 1 to 2 on Saturday, March 28th. The hour-long program, free with museum admission, will examine the printing press as revolutionary technology and the concept of freedom in the press. Volpe will also discuss laws and acts passed to control printers and the rebellious printing in the American colonies before 1776. Replicas and examples of historic documents will be on display after the talk. A Patriots' Day celebration on Saturday, April 18th, will reportedly organized by local historian E. Philip Brown, include a light and drone show near Harbor Place, according to Jimmy Carboni. Brown has also floated the possibility of illuminating the Bastillier Bridge and Haverhill City Hall in red, white, and blue lighting. He shared projected images on Facebook of how the local landmarks could glow against the night sky in patriotic colors. Brown also announced that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers approved the concept of a water curtain show on the Merrimack River for Haverhill's celebration, featuring music, projected images, and lighting cast upon a wall of water. Folks can also look out for a history of trivia night that has been slated for May 14th, without a venue declared yet. From June through July, the cities will host a month of museums, during which each of Haverhill's designated cultural treasures will offer special programming. The sites include Winnikenny Castle, Tattersall Farm, Buttonwoods Museum, Whittier Birthplace, and the Haverhill Firefighting Museum. The city's annual July 3rd fireworks celebration, traditionally one of Haverhill's largest gatherings, will have a little extra flair this summer. City officials have previously described this day as the main event of Haverhill's 250th commemorations. organizers have also emphasized the need for live readings of the Declaration of Independence through year-round programming. The events are promoted by and coordinated with Harold's 250th Commission, formed by Mayor Belinda Barrett last year. The commission, which guides all local commemorations, is led by Downtown Events Coordinator Haley Pearson. The group also includes Thomas Sullivan, Peter Carboni, Brown, Katie Cook, Vincent Ouellette, Ben Delaware, McKinnon Jennings, Reverend Kenneth Young, Jim Carboni, Greg Bourgeois, Suzanne Gates, John Kimball, Marilyn Keith Daly, Penelope Guerrero, Allison Gulubicki, Thomas Spitaleri, Andrew Volpe, Catherine Brenzahan, Andrew Harrelly, David Schultz, and Lindsay Paris. They plan on doing a number of different events throughout the year and a couple of bigger events, Barrett said. To accomplish this, we do have money put aside, but to help supplement that, they have requested a fund that we can put dedicated money into for the 250th celebration. On Tuesday, the Haverhill City Council approved the establishment of Haverhill 250th Celebration Gift Fund, presented by Barrett to support programming and allow the city to accept donations dedicated to anniversary events. The commission encourages community groups to take part in the city's tribute to America's founding. Historic properties, nonprofits, service clubs, youth groups, and schools can submit events for inclusion on this official 250th anniversary calendar. This is a wonderful opportunity to share stories and create programming that celebrates Haverhill's role in American history, Pearson wrote. Consider organizing a public reading of the Declaration of Independence with your school or club. Additional details will be announced as events are added to the calendar. From the opinion page of the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, we have Beach Dreams, Beach Days, Only a Dream for Now by Joe DeMore, who pens the Outward View or the North Boston Media Group. He leads contemplative hikes in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, Cape Cod, and other places. I am at a tender juncture in mourning while driving by the shuttered food places on the beach, crusted by snow and ice. My heart is yearning earnestly in anticipation of a return to lazy summer days. I wish to feel now the sensation of hot sand on my feet, refreshing breezes on my face, and beautiful morsels of food passing my lips. The funny thing about French fries is that when sprinkled with salt, they immediately emit a wonderfully enticing odor. In sunshine, you can see the sheen of grease on their sides. Quick bite of a few immediately after the paper boat holding them is thrust into eager hands allows a brief episode of crunchiness. But this is fleeting. French fries have split personalities. The crispness yields to softer texture in a matter of minutes. The exposed sections bathed in succulent ketchup offer a different experience. Sweet, salty, almost doughy. It's a symphony of flavors and physical sensations. This is the only food I know where there is a race against time while consuming it. The steaming potato planks produce little pleasure when eaten cold. Pizza was invented in Naples, which has a sprawling seaport. But beach pizza has been perfected in places where sunbathers bask in the sun and lovers hold hands with hearts beating rhythmically with the cadence of the waves. In fact, the record indicates Salisbury Beach as the epicenter of creation. Thankfully, this delight formed on a thin square of flaky crust sparsely layered with provolone cheese suspended on a blanket of sweet tomato sauce as emigrated to other beaches on the North Shore. Some also command prominent sections in the supermarket freezers, but honestly, it just doesn't taste the same without the sound of ocean waves crashing in the background. Enjoyed piping hot from the oven, my favorite temperature, though, is 80 degrees, the same as the perfect beach day. I can go on endlessly about Italian sausage merged with peppers and onions, steaming hot dogs, creamy roast beef sandwiches, mealy sugared fried dough, salve-like ice cream, crispy cold beverages. And what about root beer floats? doughy salted baked pretzels, and fried clams, complete with sand-filled bellies. I miss them so. And the crowds, and the sounds, chattering teens, squealing children, cars honking, motorcycles roaring, music blaring, surf pounding, screams of protesting gulls. Oh, what a wonderful cacophony transpires on a New England beach. These pulsating sensations are not totally dormant, but held at bay in the creases of my imagination. They are faint but undistinguishable. This is a smoldering melancholy, true love unrequited. Can't imagine how terrible the seagulls must feel this time of year. It's a shame they can't hibernate like bears and avert these insufferable conditions. But thankfully, the winter solstice has passed. Every day there's a march towards adding minutes of sunlight to the clock. Therefore, in the not-too-distant future, boards covering the store windows will melt like snow. Fryolators will rev up like engines at a NASCAR event. The wafts from the grills will mix with ocean air again. Then, only then, unshackled from the imprisonment of winter, I'll join blare-eyed waves of beachgoers reverting to familiar shores like repatriated foreigners. We shall seek solace and renewal while clinging to our towels along with fries, pizza, and ice drinks. We'll be like pilgrims with religious talismans, clasped firmly in our hands, experiencing redemption while in a warm embrace of dazzling sunlight. And a letter to the editor from, well, the first one is for, is by Joseph Stillmark, and it's about the trust fund position. I am writing to announce my candidacy as a writing candidate for trustee of the trust funds in Londonderry March 10th election. Trustees, the trust funds manage important town resources, including capital reserves and donated assets that support our community's long-term needs. This work requires careful attention to detail and sound fiscal stewardship. When I learned this position would be uncontested, I felt compelled to step up. Democracy works best when voters have choices, and every position on our ballot deserves thoughtful consideration from multiple candidates. I believe Londonderry residents should have options. I'm a lifelong New Hampshire resident who was called Londonderry home for 9 years. My wife and I have 2 children in Londonderry schools, and I've coached youth basketball and soccer in our community. Professionally, I lead teams and projects, make data-driven decisions, and analyze complex information, skills that translate well to managing these important town resources. I'm running because I want to give back to a community that has given my family so much. If you believe voters deserve a choice and that our trust funds deserve careful management, I'd appreciate your support. To vote for me, write in Joseph Stelmach on your ballot under trustee of trust funds. Learn more at writeinjoe.com. Joseph Stelmach, Londonderry. And here's another one by Marilyn Hoffman. March 10th, please vote for supervisor of the checklist to protect your right to vote. Vote for John Ambrose. He will protect the integrity of the voter list. I spoke to Brian Crowley, the other candidate at the meet and greet candidates event. He told me that he believes that the election of 2020 was stolen, that Trump won, not Biden. Told me it was a good idea that Trump administration seized ballots in Georgia this year to check for fraud. That election was over 5 years ago. The ballot was recounted 3 times, and Trump did not find his 11,000 votes that he asked for. He lost Georgia. Seizing the ballots now is done only for retribution and intimidation. Mr. Crowley also told me that he believes that New Hampshire should send all our voter information to Washington, D.C., along with your Social Security number and secure information. New Hampshire Secretary of State has rightly refused to do so because the information could be misused. Also, state law prevents it. Crowley would encourage it. Brian is a hardworking person and your neighbor. However, he might wrongly purge voter lists in the name of free and fair elections. Our voter list is accurate and carefully checked. There is almost zero fraud in New Hampshire elections. If you want to protect the integrity of the voter list, please vote for John J. Ambrose for supervisor of the checklist. Town elections impact your life in important ways and are Town elections impact your life in direct ways and are important. Please vote. Let's go on to back here. We should have We do not have today in history. I do not see it. We have a sports story. Rivals Lopez and Rooks share MVC's top honor. AAU teammates in the Mass Rivals program, captains for both Merrimack Valley Conference co-champs Andover's John Roos and Central Catholic's Javi Lopez, have one thing in common. The two returning Eagle Tribune super teamers now share the title of the 2026 MVC Division I Player of the Year, an award voted on by the league's coaches. Each of the athletes was adamant co-players of the year was really the only way to go. "It's great to share the league MVP with him," said Rue, a junior for the Warriors. "He's obviously super talented and is really going to excel at the next level. He's also a great competitor and great person too," Lopez concurred. "Rue is a special player as a junior playing like he did. It was kind of like how I had a great year last year," added Lopez, the Raiders senior and all-time leading scorer at the school. "Each has a mutual respect for the other and what makes them so tough on the court. He's always great to play against," said Rue. "Every time, no matter where or when, I know it's going to be a battle with Javi." Lopez, like Rue, would love to see one more round between the two rival squads. It would be the ultimate challenge in his amazing Central career. "His ability to hit shots makes him tough. You can't give him any space or let him feel comfortable. He's not afraid to shoot it from anywhere," Lopez said. "I hope to see him in the state championship in Lowell. That, of course, would be the ultimate for Hoops fans in the region, but we'll have to see how the tourney plays out." Also taking home top honors was Golden Warriors coach Dave Fazio, who was named Division I Coach of the Year. And some Dear Abby to end the day. "Family's black sheep could use a little help now and then. Dear Abby, I was always a wild child and did pretty much what I wanted. My four siblings stuck to the straight and narrow. We stayed close and loving, though. We are old now, and they all lead very comfortable lives. I, however, became injured and gravely ill. I could no longer work and now live on supplemental security income and food stamps. My siblings all give generously to food banks and homeless charities, even putting some homeless people up in hotels, which is great. But not one of them thinks to ask me if I have enough food or anything. I'm really hurt. Luckily, my affordable housing will offer some food for the residents, so I'm okay. Should I say something to my siblings? Occasionally in the past, they have helped me, like buying a new chest of drawers or some minor thing. They could easily support me if they wanted to. Should I just be grateful or what? Underperforming in California. Dear underperforming, your relatives are not mind readers. If you need help, speak up. Explain the problem, ask for help in plain English. The worst I can do is refuse, and you will be no worse off than you are. Dear Abby, I'm worried about my husband's grief response. His mom collapsed and died in our driveway. At the time, I responded quickly. I made sure everyone was fed and paid for the funeral service. That was all fine. But now I don't understand why he's not grieving. I love my husband very much, but this has me confused. Please advise. Letting it out in Oregon. Dear Letting It Out, please accept my sympathy for the shocking loss of your mother-in-law. We are not clones in the way we respond to death. Everybody does it differently, including your husband. If his mother was a strong influence in his life, he will feel her absence. If he's still eating and sleeping well and is able to concentrate, do not let this absence of emotion worry you. This is his journey, and if anything changes, your doctor can refer him to a grief support group. Dear Abby, I'm a disabled person. When I go to a doctor's office or restaurants, there are usually two doors to get in. Sometimes if somebody's coming in or out, they will hold the door open for me. However, when they do, almost every time, another person will push past me, almost knocking me down. What can I say to them about their rudeness? One of these days, they might be in my position and need someone to hold the door for them. The next time it happens, I'm going to tell them the door was held open for the disabled person, not you. Be glad you can walk well. What would you say, Abby? I can't believe how rude the country's getting. Dear Trying, a better word than rude to use would be entitled. If it happened to me, I would say loudly that the door was held for me because of my disability. Then I would add how fortunate I felt not to have been injured again this time. You have been listening to Lowell Associations for the Blind, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUMLFM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you for listening. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or you may visit our website, where you can tune into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Barry. Thank you for listening. I hope you are doing well. We will talk to you again soon. We will always strive to do better. Be well.